In January 2009, celebrated author and activist Jeff Halper gave a press conference surrounding his views on the invasion of the Gaza Strip. This is part two of a three-part series.
That's a problem, because, you know, historically, the Israeli peace movement has been for a two-state solution. In other words, you know, what I showed you here, the two-state solution that, again, the PLO accepted in 1988 already. Our problem is that if you look at the facts on the ground, the reality on the ground, it's very hard to really believe that that's still possible. In other words, the Israeli settlement project has gotten so advanced. I mean, there's 500,000 Israelis in big cities in the West Bank that it doesn't seem, without massive international pressures that I don't see coming right now, it doesn't seem that the two-state solution is doable anymore. In which case, you know, the specter is apartheid. I mean, unfortunately, apartheid is the most likely outcome that isn't acceptable to us. Or, of course, the idea of a one-state solution. That is anathema to Israel, because Israel wouldn't be a Jewish state and is kind of a non-starter. So in fact, we're in a tragic conflict that doesn't seem to have a political solution today. And I guess our role in the peace movement is to point that out. And also to say, like I've said, this is a global conflict. This isn't a localized thing. This impacts globally. And therefore, to try to bring home to the Canadian people and the government and so on how crucial it is to resolve this. In other words, I don't think that if you want to bring stability to the Middle East, if we want to try to get to a functioning global system, this conflict can remain. This is like the bone in the throat that you can't avoid it. You've got to deal with this because it has that symbolic importance. This conflict is more important for Muslims the world over than Iraq is, even if it's not the dimensions of Iraq. And therefore, in a sense, I guess, my role is to impress on decision makers and the public how important it is to resolve this conflict and to bring up the difficulties in resolving it. And then to try to create some kind of a process in which then people will begin to say, well, okay, so now what do we do about this?
What's your sort of dread, or what's the worst possible outcome if we don't resolve this peacefully?
Well, I think I think this is one of the forces that's fostering Islamic fundamentalism, you know, throughout the Muslim world. In other words, I think that that the fundamentalism which is emotional, and it's very anti-Western, obviously sort of anti-global in certain ways, is a real danger, because this conflict is still defined as a political conflict. You even have the Saudi Initiative, as it's called. The Saudis, in 2002, offered Israel regional integration if it gives up the occupation. Once this becomes, and that's where we're headed, once this conflict, you know, links up with other grievances throughout the Muslim world, and this becomes really a clash of civilizations, this becomes a religious-based global conflict, well, then we begin to lose control. You see, then for example, in Israel, the settlers are digging tunnels from the Silwan village, which is a Palestinian village just below the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They're digging tunnels under the mosque. And Jerusalem's in an earthquake belt. The idea being that at the next earthquake, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock will collapse because they're weakening the foundations. I mean, it sounds nutty. and it sounds, but it's being done, and this is playing with fire. I mean, I can't begin to tell you the centrality of Jerusalem in the religious consciousness of Muslims. So what I'm saying is that I think the danger is that this is going to bring the conflict into areas, religious and civilizational areas, where it goes beyond the ability to resolve it politically. And then you begin to undermine the regimes that exist. I mean, Mubarak, I think, you know, Nasrallah in Lebanon called 2 weeks ago for the Egyptian people to rise up and overthrow Mubarak. If he goes, Abdullah goes in Jordan. So that we're looking at a kind of a domino effect, in a sense, that if the Muslim masses begin to feel that that this really is a kind of a modern-day crusade against them, and it goes beyond the limits of the political, I think we're facing a kind of a global reality that's really scary, because it's violent, it's antagonistic, but it doesn't have a solution because it's gone beyond the political. So I'm trying to impress on people the urgency and the global dimensions of this conflict, so that even if you're not an Israel-Palestine wonk, even if you don't necessarily care about this conflict, you begin to understand that without resolving this, you're not going to resolve Iraq and Pakistan and Iran and the whole issue of fundamentalism in the world.
I still haven't heard from you a suggestion of what the solution is.
Ah, well, you know, our view is, you know, one reason is that you don't hear that from me is in a sense, we have the, you know, I think that this is, in a way, the Palestinians' prerogative to say what the solution is. Because I have a country, I have Israel. It's a very powerful state. Small, but it's a pretty powerful state. The Palestinians have to be the ones to say what is the solution. They've said the two-state solution, and that's still their official policy. But then, of course, then my role is to say, okay, well, I would support that, but this is what I've learned on the ground. I don't know if it's going to happen anymore. The Palestinians, I think, are in the process of moving, certainly in the diaspora, you see it, towards a one-state solution. To say, let's transform a national liberation struggle into a struggle for civil rights, like in South Africa. And that's a whole different kind of a struggle. We could go there as well. I think the one-state solution is a very attractive idea. I mean, I think we could really, you know, binational states have never been very successful. So I think the idea of trying to develop a model for that, Israelis and Palestinians, could actually be a real challenge. So I like that idea. So in a sense, I don't have a solution that I can pull out of my sleeve and say, this is what we're headed for. I mean, we could go with a two-state solution, we could go with a one-state solution, and we could go with a regional confederation, you know, an idea of sort of like a Middle East European community has been raised. So we're saying we have to resolve this conflict. What form that takes exactly is still out. There isn't one solution that I can say today that we support. We support any solution that gets us out of this mess.
From the Israeli government's perspective, they'll say, you know, if the international community wants to wait, and they'll say, but it was our problem. How do you?
Whose problem? Is his? Yeah, it's an eternal problem.
Yeah.
Like? Yeah, but it's obviously it's not. I mean, you know, that's part of our message as well. We're saying to the Americans, for example, that this is really affecting. I mean, first of all, you're involved. You're sending arms. You know, the United States has promised $30 billion in new arms to Israel over the next 10 years. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty involved. And beyond that, you know, again, this is affecting American interests and Canadian interests, like you've said. So, or I guess not on the radio. I was just on now. They're talking about the Canadian troops in Afghanistan and how this could impact that situation. So I think that in a situation like this, that's really a global conflict, there isn't any such thing as our internal This is butt out. This is our problem. It's not an internal problem. Not on the basis of Israel's ability to maintain the occupation, and not in terms of the implications and the impact of this on everybody. And also, you know, there's been a change since World War II, and that is the human rights perspective that's emerged in the last 60 years. In the human rights perspective of politics, there is no more internal issue. Human rights are universal. And everyone, there's a concept in international law that's called universal jurisdiction. That means that every court in every country has an obligation to ensure the human rights of peoples all over the world. So the idea that Hitler had, that the Jewish problem is a German problem, stay out. No, because what the Geneva Conventions say is that doesn't work anymore. Where there are violations of human rights, these are the word we use. I mean, these are crimes against humanity. They're not crimes against Jews or Palestinians or anybody else. Against humanity, and therefore all humanity has a responsibility to be involved. And I think that's a very significant and important change in attitudes, especially in the global reality that we live in.
So how does this affect, for instance, Canadian soldiers fighting in Afghanistan if we don't resolve the conflict with Hamas?
Well, it's like I said, I think you could make an argument that the Taliban and the different forms of very aggressive civilizational fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, is fostered by these kinds of conflicts. By these, in other words, you know, I don't like the word terrorism, but in a sense, the Hamas are very different from Al Qaeda or Taliban. The Hamas are Palestinian. They're Palestinians, and they have a religious ideology, and they're connected to other religious Muslim movements, but their mission is to liberate Palestine. It's very political, in a sense. And that's why you could deal with Hamas. Al-Qaeda, and you know where this is going, it's what I was saying before about this becoming a religious conflict, a civilizational conflict, and not political. You have elements like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and others who don't have particular political agendas. I mean, they're not saying we're in a conflict with the West and we want 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a civilizational kind of a struggle. And I think as Muslims throughout the world are either oppressed, or what they also see is that the Arab regimes and the Muslim regimes are corrupt and they're supported by the United States and the West. In other words, Mubarak is a terrible dictator. I mean, Egypt is an awful place in terms of human rights and economic development and everything. He stays in power because of support of the West. I mean, there used to be a communist party in Egypt that was destroyed. Most of these regimes are very corrupt and very repressive. So the Muslim peoples are like anybody else. They want to get on with their lives, they want a good life, they want economic development, they want openness, they want even democracy. The Palestinians are very proud of their democratic traditions and so on. But they're being frustrated by the West, and they're in a sense asking, why? Why does the United States and Canada want to preserve these regimes and not let us, the people, enter the world and benefit and so on? So the answers that they come up with aren't political answers. The West is anti-Muslim. The West still thinks in terms of the Crusades. You know, the West, you know, they, even if they're kind of demonizing the West, just like we demonize them, it becomes a kind of a conflict that's civilizational. And I think that's true in Afghanistan. So that if, let's say, bringing Canadian troops back is dependent on stabilizing the Afghan situation and the region in general, because Afghanistan can't be separated from Pakistan and Iraq and so on, you've got to get at the basic grievances that are underlying the Taliban and underlying the resistance which have to do, again, with everything we've talked about, but to a large degree, the Israel-Palestine conflict is like the what would you call it? What would you say? The bell measure? The bellwether? In other words, what I'm saying is that if the West would genuinely interfere on the side of an Arab people to end an occupation and to end the oppression, especially against Israel, because this occupation is seen as an American, Western, Israeli occupation, not as an Israeli one. If they would see that the West would act against Israel for the benefit of a Muslim people, that would go a long way towards getting this bone out of the throat, towards releasing a dynamic in which now you could engage with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. You know, I mean, the United States and Canada and Europe won't talk to Hamas. Well, what's the message in that? It isn't that you're our enemy, because we talk to our enemies all the time. That's how you resolve conflicts. It's that you're beyond an enemy. We won't even talk to you. You don't exist. You're completely illegitimate. I mean, you think about it. You know, we talk to the Nazis. You know, we talked to, you know, in different, you know, the Vietnamese to get the Vietnam conflict to resolve. And we talk to our enemies all the time. What does it mean that you refuse to talk to a liberation group of a people? And the Hamas that in some ways, again, has that image that's pan-Muslim, it means that you are really dissing all of us. That you're not, that you see us not even as enemies. It's just something to be kind of erased or negated or something. So that I think that you could make a case that in order to get the Canadian troops out of Afghanistan and to stabilize Afghanistan, to stabilize the global system, it leads back to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Do you think there's enough time? Do you think that removing that bone from the throat would remove the conflict from across the Arab world?
Yeah. I do. Look, it's not the only conflict. I mean, it's not the only basis of, you can't keep American troops in Iraq and have an end either. I mean, it's not the only, I'm not saying it's the only solution, but I'm saying this would relieve a lot of that civilizational conflict and things become more political where you could, I mean, it would indicate that the West is willing to address the grievances of the Muslim world, rather than simply dismissing them as terrorists or whatever we do. And the Palestinians have one really important source of clout in all of this. And that is that they're the gatekeepers. In other words, for the Muslim world, and you know, beyond the Muslim world, many people in Europe, I think, are also very supportive of the Palestinians and in Africa and other parts of the world as well. And that is that the until the Palestinians say this conflict is over, it's not over. In other words, Israel and the West cannot impose this apartheid thing. It can try to do it by force, but it can't do it. You can't. The Palestinians have that symbolic power in a sense. So that if you get to a situation where the Palestinians say, okay, you know what? We've reached a political agreement that's okay with us. Now is the time to normalize relations with Israel. If they have that message, the bigger message is now is the time to normalize relations in general with the West. Because Israel is sort of seen as this test case of the West in a way. This is where the hot conflict is there. So if you break through on the Israeli issue, I mean, if the Palestinians are saying to the Muslim world, normalize now with Israel, it's okay, then in a sense, there's a much bigger message to that. And that then opens the way towards reconciliation and negotiations and political processes. Until that time, that's, I think, the clout of the Palestinians. The West is embroiled not only in the Israel-Palestine conflict, but in this global conflict with the Muslim world. And that's, I think, you know, the power that the Palestinians have in this whole global